Now, this story about Alma and his conversion, his confrontation with the angel, is immensely important. I mean, it's as important as anything in the Book of Mormon, and it's directly applicable to us. It belongs to us. These things that concern us closely. Hey, the button came off this morning. Oh, what all goes on? American made. These concern us very closely, these things do. And we're told in the fourth verse of the next chapter, in fact. No, we're not told it there. What we're talking, yes. 14th verse of the next chapter, I think, yes. That these things are very important to find out. I see it not there, but I thought it was there. It tells us there that we... 20 and 14. Well, let's begin again then. What we have here, as I say, the issue is to be decided is this. Which world shall we take seriously? Now, what kind of name will we give the real world? Because this is not the real world. I mean, all you have to do is look at anything you want, stock market reports or the Cone of Time or the newest book of by Glack on chaos. Chaos has become a very scientific study now. Beyond all rules, beyond all regulation you can think of, beyond every rule of science, there is an element of chaos that must be accounted for. And it's very serious. It's very important. And it's becoming one of the major fields of science within the last couple of years or so. And that's very important. The book by Glack I would recommend to you. I haven't finished it yet. But the experience of Alma Junior and his friends is our experience as far as this goes, you see. We must all decide how seriously we're going to take this side or this side. He laughed at the other side very... He took it lightly, of course, wanted to make fun of it and have his fun here. And how much does this count for? Well, let's get started on it. You see what happens to Alma. He's at the top of his form, and he's at the top of the wave. He's the darling of the city. Everybody's following around, and he has his gang, the three most important, the sons of the king, and his own. He's the son of the high priest, and they're going around, and they really are raising hell, having an awful time. And I say he's at the top of his flight, and all of a sudden, whether it's in a narrow street or outside, I don't know, but suddenly he's stopped cold. There's a shaking of the earth, there's dust in the air, there is confusion, they hear sounds, they hear thunder, obviously an earthquake going along with it, but with it, an angel stops him dead in his tracks, just like that. What a reversal. Talk about embarrassing moments, this is it. Catches him dead to rights here, and he rebukes him. And you know what happens. How would you react to that? What could you reply in that? I mean, talk about being caught off guard, talking about being humiliated, talking about being turned upside down. The only thing he does is just stand there and go blank with a foolish look on his face, and he's frozen, he's stiff, he can't do anything. He's paralyzed. It's just what you would do in such a situation. You see, how would you handle it? You couldn't handle it, because this is a complete reverse. Is he going to explain to the angel what he's going to do? Is he going to try to talk himself out of it or something like that? You don't do that to an angel as far as that goes. And so the subject comes up here. Why do these rascals get to see an angel and none of the rest of us do, you see? It's very important, you see. There are lots of people that have lived righteously all their lives. They're never going to see an angel. But you notice throughout the Book of Mormon and elsewhere, angels only appear in times of great crisis to reverse the course of history. They turn it around. Whether it was Angel Moroni to Joseph Smith, whether it was the Angel Gabriel to Zechariah, it started things going in a reverse direction. It reaches a point where everything has to be changed, and this has great results. As you know, what's going to follow from this is basic to the end of the Book of Mormon history. Going to have a very important thing happen. So he gets turned around. Well, his three friends carry him home, and it's either in the square. If it was a Pueblo type, it would be in the square in front of the house, because Alma was the high priest, and he would have a porch there, sort of an atrium. And they bring him in the house, and a multitude gathers around, and everybody's talking at once, and Alma Jr., a majestic figure, comes out and says, what's going on here? They all start explaining to him. He was carried helpless until he was laid before his father. They rehearsed unto his father all that had happened. I imagine it was breathless, and there was everybody talking at once, the way these things happen. But Alma, who had had plenty of guidance and revelations himself, knew exactly what had happened. He said, oh, happy day, the reaction they didn't express, bring all the people around. Put on the fire, my maidens fair. Fetch water from the well. For my three sons are home this night. I'm bringing water from the well. All of us shall feast this night, for my three sons are well. That's an ancient Scots ballad, you see. When the sons finally come home, we're going to celebrate. It's the prodigal son, except these had come from the other world. They were spirits. That's another story. We'll go into that. The wife of Usher's well. He's dumb and he's out, and then he sends messengers to bring the priest, he's the high priest. Gather the brethren of the quorum and we'll pray for Alma. He knows what the situation is. They pray for 2 days, and then Alma finally bestirs himself and comes out of it. Now, the question is this. Why are we expected to invest in an unseen proposition? You know, what evidence do you have for the other world at all? What any reason why you just shouldn't celebrate here and make this the whole show? See? This is what they, as far as Alma was concerned, I have an older brother the same way, now he's coming around, but he was that way all his life. He was really a wild one, and he just poo-pooed everything. He didn't exactly always disbelieve it all the way, but he made a big show. He reinforced himself in his position, you see, by making fun of things. You have to do that. You can't just take it indifferently. So, this happens here. Why should the average person believe in the other world? What experience does he have of it? Well, for one thing, he has a vacuum that disturbs him from time to time, no matter who he is, and then there's a tradition that moves into the vacuum. There's been a connected stories going along all the time, but it is there, but that's just tradition and the vacuum and so forth. Now, here, we'll see what explains this here. They unite their faith and prayers and bring him around, and then he comes back and he said, I have repented of my sins and have been redeemed, the Lord. Behold, I am born of the Spirit. This sounds like born again. Is he going to get out of it so easy, all those years of sneering and this sort of thing? Now all he has to do is have one experience, says, I'm born again, behold, and everything is all right. Don't worry, he's not getting out of it easy at all. This was the passage 28:4 I was thinking of before, where just a hint ahead here. The Lord did the Spirit of the Lord there, the very vilest of sinners. Now, this was after their conversion, you see. The Lord saw fit infinite mercy to spare them. Nevertheless, they suffered much anguish of soul because of their iniquities. They suffered the rest of their lives because of what they had done. And they went, they did put themselves to every extreme of effort and strain to preach the gospel, all kinds of, they were willing to undergo anything to wipe that out. When they asked to go on the mission and so forth. And so, here he said, the Lord said unto me, marvel not that all mankind must be born again. Notice, nothing less than being born all over again. We are so completely out of it, you see, when we are here. We cannot make the change without leaving the scene. You have to be born again. See, there's the one world or the other. You can't mix them. It's a very hard thing. Brigham Young says, remember, if you try to take the water on both shoulders, the Latter-day Saint who tries to live in both worlds is torn apart. There's no such agony, no worse experience than that. And it happens to them here. And so, this explains here. Born again, changed from their carnal and fallen state to a state of righteousness, a complete change, being redeemed of God, becoming his sons and daughters. They become new creatures. It's an entirely different thing. And this explains, if there's another world open to us, why don't we know about it? And this explains why we don't know about it. We're miles from removed from any kind of interface here. The people living in one or the other, to the people living in one, the other doesn't exist. It's very much like they're not going to draw time cones here. And I like the time cone, though. It's true. Nothing can exist outside of that cone of the cone of time. We'll draw that another time, I suppose. If other worlds exist, see beyond the range of speed of light of a certain time, a certain space, you can never know about it. I mean, all you can know about your existence is it's monolinear, one single line, the line you happen to be on where time and space meet. And of course, the time is measured by space and space is measured by time. It's the same thing, isn't it? But it's just one thing, and everything outside of that just isn't there. It's either past or future, and you'll never know it's there. And of course, there are absolute limits set to what you know by the speed of light. That's the constant, you see. It can go so far, and from that you structure your whole universe and all your experience, and it turns out to be a very narrow cone of experience. And the point is that everything outside of that, you'll never know and can know nothing about as long as you're in this life. Everything could exist there and you'd never know about it. So don't go making judgments that this is all there is as far as that goes. Now, you have to cut loose from the one or the other. Notice he says here, being in the other world, he had nothing to do with that one. What we call it, God's world or something like that, or the real world. We call this the real world, which it isn't. I say unto you, unless this be the case, they must be cast off. And this I know because I was like to be cast off. That means cut loose, forgotten. And there's no easy going for apostates. It's a very interesting thing. It's never been. You see, they have to be in the one or the other. It bugs them. It eats them all the time. I've never known one of them that could be at ease with it. I've known some that were genial apostates, but they all came back. It's a very interesting thing. Those that don't must fight the church and must be active about it. See, it won't let them rest. It won't leave them alone. It's not so with others. I mean, whether you change from Baptist to Methodist doesn't make much difference. But once you've known the gospel, and nobody knows it very well, once you've had any experience of that, the possibility this just might be so, it's something you'll never shake again. And again, the problem, all right, why doesn't somebody give us a hint? Why don't we hear a voice from the other side? Our dreams are crazy. They're silly dreams. They deal with trivia, as they should, unless you're able to interpret them and so forth. But where do we have the dreams and visions, the visions of glory of old returning and angels are coming to visit the earth? Well, where are they, you see? Well, the point is obvious here. If we had easy contact with that, if that was open to us, this life would be no test at all. As the Book of Mormon tells us repeatedly, this life is a probation. We're here being tested. You must be in quarantine for that. You're being watched through a one-way window, but you don't know that you're being watched necessarily. What you do here is your own behavior, and you're to be tested. It's when the heavenly beings depart, in the Adam literature, when the three visitors depart and say, we'll leave you alone now for a while, then Satan strikes. Then he says, now is the great day of my power. And he tells Adam, I'll never be back again. Just some fakes will come back. Don't worry about that. Now you're not being watched. Now you can do what you want and so forth. So if we were constantly being reminded, we had visits by angels, and Brigham Young said, pray that you'll never see an angel. Because he's talking historically, almost everybody who saw an angel left the church. They came back, but they had these terrible problems. It gave them inflated egos and so forth. They thought they were somebody special, and they were, but they couldn't take it. You see, it would be very dangerous if you were exposed to the other world to any degree of direction. Only people that are very humble can do that, and I mean that, not us. We can't do that. We're not that humble. But I mean some people of the tribe, some old Hopi or something like that, like old Tom Kuyeshra. The head of the Parrot clan, who when he heard the gospel, didn't know a word of English, but when he heard Brother Bushman talk for half an hour, he came up dressed in all his fine regalia and asked to be baptized, he says. But you didn't understand. I've just been talking to you. I know it's true. I know it's true in here, he says. And he had to be baptized. And so that's the way it is, you see. But we're not in contact with those things because we don't live that way. Is there anything more distracting than the crazy world we live in? I mean, it's become one big mad theater, one crazy TV show from beginning to end. I mean, everything from the savings and loan to the takeovers, the leveraged buyouts and all the criminality everywhere, and the drugs, and the corruption in politics, and the corruption in business, and the corruption in the military contracts, and all, everything is completely cockeyed. Don't think this is the real world. What a test for us all, you see. Remember what the Lord told Enoch. He said, behold, worlds without number have I created, and of all the workmanship of my hands there is not so much wickedness as among thy brethren. We won't even let a little slit of light through from the other world. It terrifies us. If we do, we don't want it at all. But why we should be committed to this, you've often heard it called the rat race and so forth. You can call it what you want, but it's silly enough, don't worry. So, and that's the world that Alma was in, you see. He was a playboy and all the rest of it, and what a change this had to be. But it had to be a complete change here. So we're being quarantined here, so don't expect visions and revelations and glory. You're being tested all the time. You provide them. And reading the scriptures the same way. Schiller says in a poem called Die Huldigung der Kunst, he says, Visit ein erhabener Sinn, sucht das Größe in das Leben. Bring I haven't found that for years. Ein erhabener Sinn bringt. No, it doesn't bring. Das Große in das Leben und er sucht es nicht darin. Macht es. Behold, he says, A real intelligence brings enlightenment to what it studies. It doesn't just seek it there. You bring it with you, you see. And it's the same thing here, whatever we study and what we approach. Macht bringt Zucht. What is the word he uses? An exalted spirit, he says, puts the greatness into life. It doesn't seek the greatness there. You put it there. If it's to be there at all, you've got to put it there. And Alma does. These people do. You notice these great characters in the Book of Mormon. And they work both ways. We're about to run into Nehor. And he is the opposite. A great man, a capable man, going in the opposite direction. But he says, and he speaks now in the terms of the mysteries, where he says, I'm nevertheless was a wanderer through tribulation, nigh unto death. He would rather die than go on, in other words. He was nigh unto death. He was reduced so low. Well, what, after this humiliation, after being shown what he was and being so guilty and knowing what it was, he says he was nigh unto death, repenting nigh unto death, he says. He'd sooner die than go on. He felt so bad. And the Lord, but in the Lord in his mercy has spared me that. You don't have to. He snatched me out of it. And it was a close call. The word snatch is a good one, isn't it? He snatched me out of an everlasting burning. I am born of God. My soul has been redeemed from the gall of bitterness and bonds of iniquity. Now this is the epopsia. This is the thing that was recited in the mysteries, the Jewish and the Christian and so forth, when you go from the light to the day. The epopsia is, it was imitated, see, in the temples, in the ancient temples in Egypt. You go through darkness and trials and you go through three levels and so forth. Then in the final stage, you went through a veil into a sunlit, in Egypt they had a sunlit courtyard, sun at noonday, and everything was white alabaster, trimmed in absolutely dazzling, you see, this celestial room when you went into, and it was the same with the epopsia, with the Greeks, with the mysteries. You went into a room that was brilliantly lighted after you'd been in the dark. It's called the epopsia. That is the seeing of the light, the sudden vision that pops on you when you realize it. Well, this was rehearsed. It was dramatized in the Hellenistic period, in the Hermetic, under the Hermetic teachings, when they imitated, they adapted these things, they mixed them up, they imitated them and so forth. That's another story. But this is the language he used. I was in the darkest abyss, but now I behold the marvelous light of God. My soul was racked with eternal torment, but I am snatched and my soul is pained no more. See, there's already your definition of eternal torment. You said, well, how could he be out of it? It was eternal. If his soul was racked with eternal torment, he'd still be there, wouldn't he? No, he says, I'm out of it now. I pained no more. It means the torment by nature is eternal. Anybody who qualifies for it will get it from now till the end of time. It's there all the time, not that you have to suffer it all the time. This is one of the errors of Christian theology, as you know, where they tell you, it's eternal torment. Once you go to hell, it's eternal, 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 forever and forever and forever. Well, he'd has been as bad as most people that go to hell, you see, but it's not eternal with him. You get out of it now. He remembereth every creature of his creating. That is good news. Everything outside, notice, yea, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess. So everybody's going to be included. It's future, you notice. Every tongue, everybody's going to be included in this sooner or later. Outside of his sphere, it just sounds like Stephen Hawking writing now, doesn't it, about being outside of the cone of time and nothing exists. Because everything out the sphere of influence is lost and astray. You take the man who has everything. Think of some of the men who have everything in this world. Think of the old classic Citizen Kane, the man who had everything and who had nothing. Oedipus, the classical example, the man, U tis u zelo anthropon tais tsukais. Nobody didn't envy his fabulous good luck, but look at him. And you know of Richard Corey, who strays down the street in a New England Spoon River anthology. Everybody in town entries, he's the rich, proud man, and so forth. And Richard Corey, one fine summer's night, went home and put a bullet through his head. See, he wasn't happy after all, though he had everything and everybody envied him and so forth. And Belshazzar, and Nebuchadnezzar, and Nimrod. And so we have the person who, in the scripture, the Lord gives the idea of the man who had increased his farm goods, his good, he expanded his land, had a great estate, and assured himself against the future. And he says, my soul, take your ease. Your future is guaranteed. You have all sorts of investments and time bonds, things like that. And then the voice came to him and said, thou fool, this night shall thy soul be required of thee. I think of Hisham, the mightiest palace an Arab ever built, just outside of Jericho down there. It belonged to the Dajani family and the Dajani brothers, and they took us down there. It's closed, you never can see it. I don't know whether they've made a tourist exhibit of it now or not. But this, the prince, took 27 years to build it. It was going to be the finest palace in the world, and it was the finest palace. It was magnificent. Everything later, you have no idea how expensive and how luxurious it was. And the night he was to enter it, it was to be the housewarming. It was to be open. There came a great earthquake. He had a heart attack and died. The palace was completely destroyed. The night of its, the night of its, what do we call when you open a house in a district? Well, to be the first night, they were to have this big housewarming. Everybody was to come. People all to come and everything. After 27 years, poof, that's what happens. See, this is the idea of the man who has everything. If you have everything, you're going to be awfully disappointed here. You're not going to have anything after all. And then, those, notice, who are those who live without God in the world, you see? It is possible to be utterly deserted, to be live without God. I mean, he wants to reach you, but you don't have to, and people do all the time. This generation certainly doing it. And they shall shake and quake and tremble and shrink beneath the glance of his all-searching eye. They'll try to avoid the issue right up to the end. You notice this? Not wanting to face up to it. Eventually, you'll have to. Shrink, tremble, quake, and shrink and not want to have to look him in the eye. And of course, that's the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. More terrifying than anything else, we're told. Now, from this time forward, Alma began to be a zealous teacher. He becomes alien to the one world. And to be alien to the one world, you must be alien to the other. You must be alien to the one or the other. If you're really in the gospel, of course, see how the early saints were always persecuted and so forth. They were alien to that because why were people so upset? Why did they attack them and so forth? Did they say these terrible things and do these terrible things? They didn't worry about anybody else that way. But from the very first, it bothered them terribly. Something was wrong there. Well, and so he goes traveling around in the country, just as his father had done, you see, and preaching everywhere he goes. He's going to try to make amends here. He traveled around about the country, preaching the word of God in much tribulation, being greatly persecuted. Now, this is it. Here he's the smart boy. You'd think they'd at least receive him for what he was and respect his, whether it was his background, what he'd done, the old friend. But no, they're mad at him now. He's betrayed them. And they're in a tiny minority now. By now, everybody's believing. See, so he was just going with the majority. Remember, the scripture says, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil, and that's what he was doing. No wonder he was popular. Everybody cheering him, he was telling them what they wanted to hear. If you tell people what they want to hear, then you'll be their friend, and you'll win the election. And so it is here, but now he's extremely unpopular. They don't want him anywhere. They start kicking him around here, confirming their faith, exhorting them with much long-suffering, much travail to keep the commandments of God. And he didn't fight back, you notice. Of course, he wouldn't. And four of them were the sons of Mosiah with him, and their names were, notice, now we come to the great Ammon, one of the great characters of the Book of Mormon. The oldest son of Mosiah was Ammon, who would have been the king, who would have been the priest, you see. And they traveled throughout all the land of Zarahemla. That's where they were. The four sons of Mosiah, the king, with Ammon, Aaron, Omner, and Himni. And, there's later there. And what they were doing, striving to repair the damage they'd done, striving to repair the injuries which they had done. This is another thing. When people are born again, they feel no guilt or anything about their past. When Charles Colson became an evangelist overnight, as being one, a real criminal, you know, planting murders and everything else, he was asked over TV, I heard this, personal witness, you know, he says, aren't you going to make it up to some of the people you have damaged? Aren't you going to apologize? No, at all. I'm born again. I'm pure. He says he had no guilt, no feelings of guilt, whatever. Not these people, you see. You have to make it up. You go not hence until you pay the uttermost farthing. You've got to pay every penny before you're going to get out of it. Thus they were instruments in the hands of God. After all, it was good. God turned this evil into good, and this is a thing that often happens. He turns what would be calamity into all the more glorious victory, and this is what happens. They were instrument in that, because look at the experience, look at the background they'd had, and so forth. We know of cases in the church like that, of really wicked people who've been converted and done great good. There were some very notable ones, and the other way around. For they did publish peace, they did publish good tidings of good, and they did declare unto the people that the Lord reigneth. Everything was all right. To worry is sin and folly. It, and hanging back from it is hanging back from the action is. I mean, this is good news. It's the gospel they're preaching now. Talk about happy endings. They publish peace after all this hectic story. They publish peace. They publish good tidings. And the Lord is reigning after all. And now, you see, they're helping people here, doing what they can, but their thoughts go further. How about the Lamanites? Can't we help them out too? Remember? Remember Jacob? He prayed for his own people fervently. And Enos, remember in the woods, Enos prayed for his own people. And then he prayed for the Lamanite brethren too. He says they might as well be included. And so, of course, we find them all mixed up here. And so they get that idea. Now they desired of the king that they might go to the land of Nephi, that they might preach the things to their brethren, the Lamanites. And their father was very cautious. The policy, see, they had been stung. There was the one thing that kept the peace was a very wide buffer zone between them. They had to travel through quite a wilderness to get to the Lamanites. Remember, it's a big country. So they weren't in constant conflict, and as they were when they were boarding, as in Central America, it means Central America, where they had the line of division between them, and they had the borders, and they had to fortify them, and all that trouble. They had trouble then. But here, they're having no trouble with them, and Alma Sr. doesn't want any trouble. He's very cautious. He doesn't want to let them go at first. And the policy is, he tells, well, here, I think here's his policy here. Yes, they did plead with their father many days that they might go up to the land, and he finally said unto Mosiah, the Lord finally said unto Mosiah, let them go up. This isn't Alma, he's the high priest, but it's Mosiah, his sons. The Lord finally said, let them go. So they were following a very cautious policy. They didn't want to mingle too closely with the Lamanite. But they're so filled with this, let's go and see if we can't do this to the Lamanites. If it happened to us, it can happen to them. Yes?
Before you go on to the next chapter, could you go back to verse 28
yeah.
and explain Alma's use of the word everlasting burning?
Oh, yes, he mentioned the 29th verse, he says eternal torment. Well, that's the everlasting part. It's always available, you know. But he mentions this later on. Of course, the burning, he says, it is like the burning of a real fire, he says. It is like, it consumes you. It constantly gnaws on you. You never can get it out of your system. It's like a fever. He explains it later on. And it's also made very clear that this is a metaphor, it's a figure. It's the best thing you can call it that. And yet, how near is it to real burning? This is the interesting point, you see. In physiology and so forth, a real fever can be stirred up by certain states of mind and so forth. You can think yourself into a high temperature, I don't know, this sort of thing. But these things are connected, but burning is the best image you can use, you see, an eternal burning. It doesn't mean that he's going to be in flames, surrounded by elegant imps with tridents and so forth and so on. But it means as long as he lives hereafter, no matter what progress he lives with after, he will always have that awareness and always have that guilt with him. It'll hold him back forever, you see, and that's true. Well, there are things we've all done that would be better if he hadn't done. You'll regret them forever. They'll hold you back no matter what happens hereafter. So let's make the best of it from here out. What do you say? No, the burnings, that's a figure here. And he has a good deal more to say about that a little later on. To their brethren, the Lamanites, I said, can't we help them? Perhaps they might bring them to a knowledge of the Lord their God. If the Lord reigns, there's no cause for hatred. They say, no, they're so happy at the end, or they didn't worry anymore. God was in charge of things. That being the case, why shouldn't we go to them? What have we got to worry about? God is in charge of these things. He might bring them to a knowledge of the Lord their God. And notice that perhaps they might cure them of their hatred. This is what the tradition was. They had this built-in hatred and traditional and so forth. And it was a chance. If there was any chance at all, they said, we should take it. Cure them of their hatred. How could they? Toward the Nephites, that they might be brought to rejoice. They might have fun with us. That they might become friendly one to another. Now, this is fraternizing with the enemy, isn't it? And it's the only solution to the problem here. We find this throughout the Book of Mormon. This is the basis of coexistence, not self-interest. You can prove self-interest in my land, how many times Germany and France have gone to war, and England and France and so forth, where it could be shown the North and the South, a famous book written just on the eve of the Civil War, The Impending Crisis, by, not Hoffman Kinder, in which he showed there was no profit in it at all, that neither side had anything to gain, that they would both lose terribly, it would be an awful thing, but they went right ahead and did it. You can never stop people from fighting by showing them that it's in their best interest not to. That'd be saying, it's everybody's best interest not to go to war, for heaven's sake. And Hinton Helper is the man who wrote, Hinton Helper wrote that famous work, The Impending Crisis. the first really good statistical study showing that the cotton had stopped paying off in the South. Slavery had become a burden there. After all, it wasn't paying as well as it would be, and so on, and in the North and so forth. There were as many slaves up there as there were in the South, and the like. They had nothing to gain by it. The same thing here. Hatred is stronger than self-interest here, and they'll always do it. Was this a practical idea, you asked, to go and preach to these laymen? The father hesitated a long time, remember. And he wasn't so sure about it. And how did it work out? This is a neglected leitmotif in the Book of Mormon here. But the appeal to the simple mind, of course, is the military solution. We see where we're getting nowhere with that. You'll never get anywhere. It's just going to get worse and worse as far as that goes. We're doomed if we don't have a generous impulse and act on that. It's the impulse. You're doomed if you have to be in danger of starvation before you eat. You eat because you want to, because you feel it'll be a nice thing to do. If you only drink when you're in danger of dehydration, you're not going to last long. You have to drink because you want to drink, feels good, and you'd love to do it. It's a fine thing. The same thing. You're doomed if you don't get rest, if you don't go to sleep until you're dropping of exhaustion. See, we do these things because they're the proper thing to do, and it works out, and that's the way we should, and it's the same way. We're doomed unless we yield to our friendly impulses, to our generous impulses, the more magnanimous side of human nature, and agree to be friends. You've got to do, otherwise it's going to go on and on. We know that, we've seen that sort of thing, and the Lord has told us that. And the Book of Mormon is a classic treatment of this particular subject here, this and in the case of the great Ammon, of course. But if the ideologues and so forth, what is interest and what is not in our interest isn't the first voice we listen to. We have to listen to that other voice. We're doing our best to dampen it now, and it's going to be disastrous. Well, anyway, that they might become friendly to one another. Imagine becoming friends with those people. They're their brethren. No more contentions in all the land which the Lord their God had given. God had given the land to both of them. Why would we be fighting in it? And this overrides everything. They were desirous that salvation should be declared to every creature. Like Enos, remember, Enos was completely worked up about that. When he got assurance of his salvation, then he couldn't let go. He prayed all the time, both for his own people and the Lamanites. And Alma is determined here, and the sons of Mosiah, he's determined that nobody else, well, especially Alma, as he tells us later, was determined that no one would ever have to go through what he went. He had seen hell, he had been there, and he wanted none of that. And if he could possibly help it, nobody else would have to suffer that. That was the generous impulse that drove him here. They could not bear that any human soul should perish. Yea, even the very thought that any soul should endure endless torment, what they got a taste of, you see, did cause them to quake and tremble. So they weren't happy and settled and redeemed and go back home and enjoy yourself now because you're forgiven and everything's all right. Far from it. They were just beginning to work it off now. Thus did the Spirit of the Lord work on them. It was the Spirit of the Lord. They were the very vilest of sinners after all their revelation, repentance, and so forth. Nevertheless, they suffered much anguish of soul because of their iniquity, suffered much in fearing that they should be caught right to the end. They were not safe home, you see. They were fearing that. We're told again in the Book of Mormon that God has prolonged our lives that we might have more chance to repent, because we're going to need every minute we can get. They are worried. They're not pleased with themselves. And it was a dangerous undertaking, we see in the fifth verse here. Came to pass, they did plead with their father many days that they might go up to the land of Jerusalem. Now, here's this long standoff with the Lamanites. Mosiah was very cautious here. And so then, the Lord said to Mosiah, let them go. So they do go. They took their journey in the wilderness. Notice, a wilderness divided them from the Lamanites. There was a gap there, a very useful gap. Modern countries adjacent to each other are always horrifying. Well, Germany and Prussia and Denmark, for example, and Germany and France, all border countries of all throughout the generations, wherever they are, they have fought where there's a border. If you want to read the worst and ghastliest and bloodiest, read the most intimate to the closest to borders, of course, the Scottish Border Ballads, a volume of nothing but blood and horror about people which were friends and relatives, just like the American Civil War. The North against the South, brother against brother, and so forth, that sort of thing. Nope, there's only one cure to that, we read here. They did plead with their father that they might go up, and so it was that. They took their journeys into the wilderness to go up to preach to the Lamanites. Now, King Mosiah, there was not many of his sons who would accept the kingship. This is an interesting thing. What? not ambitious, they were all in line, beginning with Ammon. Why did they turn down the kingship? Well, of course, they had a new sense of values. They knew what had priority now. They weren't, otherwise they would have jumped at it, I'm sure. It was the fact that Ammon was the crown prince, so to speak, that that he added luster to Alma, the younger, and his gang. But no, they knew what counted now. He wasn't impressed by it and wouldn't do it. And then this knowledge of the sick world. Alma had been persecuted and mocked. You see, as soon as they repented and came around, then their old friends and all the other people, the whole mob and the general public started making fun of them and giving them a very bad time, started persecuting them. Well, would you want to be a king over that crowd, as far as that goes? He doesn't want to be king. All I want to do is preach the gospel now. That's it, as far as they're concerned. And the law is still the law of the Old Testament they're preaching. They're still preaching the Torah. Those are, remember, the bronze plates, the brass plates brought from Jerusalem is the basic law on which Benjamin and Mosiah build the organic law of the Nephites, namely, it's the law of Moses. So they took the plates of brass and also the plates of Nephi after having translated and caused to be written on them, and therefore, they were talking about King Mosiah now. He took them, and these are the national treasures along with the sword of Laban and the Urim and Thummim and so forth. And the nations have national treasures. Among the Indians, there are the Tipuni. The Hopis have the Tipuni. It's a special box like the Ark of the Covenant that has the precious things of the tribe. They have the Moncas and they have the sacred Hopi stones and things like that. Sacred symbols are great on these things. But there are certain treasures that must be kept together and they mark the integrity of the tribe, these objects. And of course in Japan you have the sacred mirror and the sword and the things that are the sacred relics of the nation that mark its legitimacy. And if you have them, well, like the crown jewels of England.
Where did Mosiah get the two stones fastened to the rims of the bow? The reason I'm asking is because when the colony is found, when they find Zenith's colony, mm-hmm. and they capture the other Ammon, and he asks him if he can translate the record that they found of the Jaredites. And
King Mosiah.
He said that the king had means at that time whereby he could translate.
Yeah.
But this appears to be what the brother of Jared hit up with his record.
Yes, and now he translated them, that is, Mosiah translated himself by means of two stones which are fastened into the two rims of a bow, the interpreting language. This is a very interesting thing now. Notice it mentions this interpreting language is a very matter-of-fact sort of thing. It's something, notice these two verses here, 15 and 16, are entirely alien to our world. We don't have anything like that today, but there are such things, I can assure you that. Talk about them in a minute. Though this is matter, but this is entirely alien to our world, as a computer would be alien to theirs. You see, a few years ago, a computer would be absolutely unthinkable, especially a computer that draws diagrams and pictures and makes portraits and does anything you want it to, you see. Well, that sort of thing is another Urim and Thummim, as far as they're concerned. Did you people really have something like that? Yes. And what did you have? Well, we had this Urim and Thummim, and it worked that way. Well, reading itself is a mystery. I was reading an awful text last night, the man weary of his of life in Egyptian in hieratic, and won't go into it, we won't go into it now, but the fact that it can be read is rather miraculous, and it really isn't very hard when you come right down to it, because all the letters look exactly alike. I mean, the M and the R and the L and the W, they're all exactly alike. That's all there is. And they put a list of these, and yet you know what they mean, because you know what they should mean in this particular context. You have to have somebody tell you. You have to have a title tell you what the subject is, and then you can go, all right, but it's quite a strain. It's like the flying of a bee. There's no reason why a bee should fly. It can be shown that aerodynamically it can't fly. But these things happen. Now, this new book is a very good one. This book by Gleick on chaos. There are things that happen beyond all control of science and everything else, and yet they do happen. See? And this has become a very serious subject for science, I say today, this one. And so you have such a thing as speed reading, for example. Whoever thought a person could read a whole page in a minute, and yet people have been known to do it. Well, that's what kind of operation of the mind is that? What's going on? See, you have to cooperate to use a Urim and Thummim. It takes far more intelligence to use a Urim and Thummim the way Joseph Smith did, more concentration. I suppose more intelligent than it does to use a grammar and a dictionary and wade your way through something like that and guess at things like that. And you notice as Joseph got more and more used to it, he didn't need either the seer stone or the Urim and Thummim. as Emma Smith says, he would just lay it aside. I can do it now. And you do the same thing if you're reading anything, like Coptic Greek or anything like that. After a while, you don't need the dictionary at all. After a while, you don't need the grammar at all. And you just sail on without them. Well, why is that? At the earlier time, you had to have somebody tell you what every word, not anymore. You see. But how is it you do it? Well, it's like trying to centipede, trying to figure out how he walks and so forth, how ice skaters work and things like, all sorts of things that operate that shouldn't do, that operate in a rather miraculous way. And the seer stone is one of these. These work, the crystals, of course, do concentrate, have that strange quality of concentrating light, but they concentrate the attention at least. And so there are various techniques. And now, here, why they go, something I was going, well, here we go anyway. So it's a strange thing. It could have the bow, or it could not have the bow. As I say, the oldest title of Pharaoh in Egypt is that of the aware of the Wer Ma'a, the greatest of seers. And it is simply written with two stones side by side.
So it's possible that Mosiah had a seer stone or something before they found the
Yeah, it
the
doesn't bow. See, okay. You notice in the case of Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon, if he didn't have the Book of Mormon, we'd say that he was faking the whole thing, but he had the Book of Mormon, he wasn't faking anything. Sometimes it was the seer stone, sometimes it was the Urim and Thummim, and sometimes it was neither. Sometimes it was inspiration. The seventh chapter, the seventh section of the Doctrine and Covenants is a translation of a particular doctrine. It's a parchment written by John and hidden up by him. Now we know since the Dead Sea Scrolls that in John's day everybody was writing on parchments and everybody was hiding them up in the desert. And this is exactly what happened. It's probably one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But we don't have the scroll. Joseph Smith translated. He didn't have the scroll, but he says it was translated from a scroll. And sometimes the words would appear, the letters would appear. Emma Smith said Joseph never read a proper name. He always spelled it out. He could see it spelled out for him. Because if he had to read it, being what he was, Oliver Cowdery, being the clerk he was, if the one had given phonetically what he read, and the other had heard, written down phonetically what he said to him, you wouldn't recognize a single name in the Book of Mormon. They had to be spelled out, so they can be reliably used as evidence, philological evidence, and so forth. No, this is a disciplina arcana, you see. This is hermetic. Notice, whoever has these is called a seer after the manner of old times. That's what I mean. It belongs to another culture and to another world. I've been doing a lot of stuff in this hermetic writing now, and it's been emerging recently, that they were doing things and saying things and had knowledge we don't have. We've sort of joked about it in the past, but they really did, and they were able to do... Well, of course, the classic example is the pyramids, as Santayana, the scientist at MIT, says. They weren't idiots that built that. You had to be consummate engineers and mathematicians to achieve what they did there, and yet we have nothing of what they did it with. We don't know. It's like all this stuff about all this stone cutting they do, tremendous, gigantic, cyclopean masonry without metals. How are they going to cut the stone with other stones and so forth? Well, something going on here. Well, we're not going on to Arthur Clarke's program here, are we? Unsolved mysteries. But whoever is called a seer, as Ma'a, the Ma'a means a seer, and it's written with an I, you see, and then it's written with the two stones under it. And so, then, it gave an account. Now, this is an interesting thing. What did it give? It gave an account of the people who were destroyed, from the time they were destroyed back to the building of the Great Tower, which was destroyed. Well, can't we have anything less negative than that? Why must it always be the grim message? Why is that necessary? Well, Mormon and Moroni, who give us the book, they are physicians. They're healing. They're meant to heal. The Book of Mormon is a prescription for people that are very sick. It's for us, you see. So it's going to talk about the diseases that we have. Building of the Great Tower, and even until the creation of Adam. Now, this account did cause the people of Mosiah to mourn. They didn't like it. They mourned exceedingly when they read it. It was very sad. Again, why would that be? Where's our crisscross here? Such a shockingly sad story. In other words, it's our story. It's like American history. It's a ghost town sort of story. It's expedient that all people know, this is what I was talking about, and what this does apply to us. It's expedient that all people should know the things that are written in that account about Ether. Everybody should know that, because this is the classic story of what happened, you see. And were they expecting something great? They got something very sad. Well, now, these are solemn admonitions is what they receive. And yet, what happens next? Nevertheless, gave them much knowledge in which they did rejoice. They rejoiced in the knowledge, in the ultimate assurance that there is something, someone who knows and someone who cares. That we are not an atom on a speck, as William James says, an atom on a speck of dust spinning around a bubble of gas. There's more to it than that, you see. So this gives us great knowledge and great reassurance, and they did rejoice because the story was being told to them for a purpose, not just to gloat over their fate and say, this is what's going to happen to you. No, it doesn't have to, and it's all good news. This account shall be written hereafter, behold, is expedient, we all know it, as far as that goes. What's heckier to him here? And then they had the... They had this document, the plates of brass. They had Moses, the bronze plates. And which, remember, in Joseph Smith's day, the word bronze wasn't used at all, not until the 1880s. That was a French word that was adopted by the Arabs, but it means the same thing. And all these things were kept and conferred upon Alma, who was the son of Alma. So it's the state treasures. We keep the, for example, the British proudly preserve the Magna Carta. We preserve the original Constitution. It's a thing. It's a token. It is a... It's a talisman, really, sort of a thing. It's to attract our concentration and rally our attention and so forth, bring us together. We have these things. The Bible, of course, is a classic example of that. The cultural core of things like the Torah, like the Tipponi, like the Magna Carta, like constitutions. This is what this was. And all this stuff was conferred upon Alma, who was the son of Alma. All the records handed down from one generation to another, even as they had been handed down from the time Lehi left Jerusalem. The Old Testament is unique in that it does hand down the records, and unadorned. That's the interesting thing. Remember, other records we have, but they are ritualized and glamorized. The king always wins, and he's all-powerful in this, that, and the other, whether it's the East, the West, the Orient. But in the Old Testament, whether it's Solomon or whether it's David, they are mortals and they are sin, and they can be very wicked men, and they have their faults, and they lose battles as well as win them. They're chased out, they're chased around and so forth, whether it's a great priest like Elijah or Samuel, they have their sufferings. Nothing is prettied up in the Old Testament at all. It tells it like it is, as we say. That's the only ancient chronicle that does. The rest of them are very strongly leaning, of course, toward the administration. Well, then the next chapter is on government. It's the last one in Mosiah. We've got to get to Alma sometime, don't we? Yeah. So let's hurry. We won't have time to finish it in the hour. I can see that. Well then, this has been a very sobering lesson now. And it's a lesson on kingship. And this chapter now is a lesson on government. When Mosiah had done this, he sent out among all the people desiring to know who they wanted to be their king. This is the great assembly. This is the, which happens in all ancient societies, the corroboree, the gathering of the tribes, the festival, you have to come together, the powwow, when everybody in a particular tribe is required to come. And they're always for the spring equinox or at the solstice. And they were desirous that Aaron, his second son, should be king. And this episode might be one right out of the ancient Near East. You have interesting accounts of the papyrus of Rechmira, an Egyptian papyrus from the 18th dynasty. The 18th dynasty. Now Aaron had gone up the land of Nephi, therefore the king could not confer the kingship on him. He went on a mission, so he couldn't take it. Didn't want it. So he sent again among the people, even a written word, he sent among the people. Remember, that's the way King Benjamin did when they couldn't reach him. He sent, and the same thing, Xenophon writes that way. Darius used to do that, send messages throughout the kingdom if he couldn't reach himself, and especially Alexander. The written record was the big thing, you see, at this time. The king who, if he couldn't reach, that was the advantage of writing. Writing makes empire possible. That's why you can reach, you have control at a distance. Without writing, you have no control at a distance, you see. You have nothing you can do. You have to be there personally. You have to send somebody, report back and forth. But with a written order, you keep a copy of it. It's only writing that makes empire possible. So that's why the Babylonians, Egyptians, they use it for that purpose. The king sent again among the people a written word. And this is the way it goes. O ye my people, or my brethren, for I esteem you as such and so forth. If there should be another appointed in his stead, I fear there would rise contentions among you. He doesn't want them to have a king. And so This is what would happen, he says. Who knoweth but what my son, to whom the kingdom doth belong, should turn angry and draw away part of the people after him, would cause wars and contentions among you, which would cause the shedding of much blood. What's the classic tragedy on that? The seven against Thebes. Remember the two brothers? Eteocles and Polynices, each one was to, they were twins, each one was to have the kingdom for a certain length of time, but when Eteocles' time came to give it up, he wouldn't give it up. So what they had to do, a duel killed each other, the seven against Thebes, and they killed each other. So this is what happens, the very thing happens, you see. There are many examples of when the time comes up, the temporary king or the exchange kings refuse to get rid. The ancient world always had two, like the Spartans, and you have two sacral kings. And the same way here, I had a long footnote in a classical journal many years ago on this particular subject. The instances in which kings in ancient times, having fulfilled their office during a season for which they'd been appointed, namely, usually it was the festival king, the lord of misrule, whatever you want to call him, the pharmacus, they would put up a king. And then when the time came up, he refused to give up the throne. This is what happened to the first of the Babylonian, of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. He refused to give it up. He was the son of a gardener. They elected him king for the period of the festival, and when it was over, he had collected gifts from the people as king. He used that money and gave them promises and the like, and he became king and founded a dynasty. Well, this sort of thing happens, and this is what would happen. He knows a thing or two about that. I see the time is up now, so now let's be wise. The oldest tragedy we know, the Supplimus, the Hecatides of Aeschylus, the king begins his very same situation. He calls all the people together, and his opening lines are, Paides chronainphrae, children, let us be wise. Let us think about these things. Let us decide what we are to do. That's the problem. We must confront. He says the same thing. He addresses about Paides from the Oedipus starts out, ends. O patras Thebes en oikoi, O citizens of a paternal Thebes, citizens born of Thebes, my children, let us consider you, fellow citizens, let's consider you. This is a common situation, and it's very clear here when they're going to launch a new government, and this is the way Mosiah goes about it in the classical manner.